This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We all have to cope with mental anguish. In the Western world, people often turn to psychotherapy for help in understanding the source of their pain. In the East, meditation and related spiritual practices have helped people quiet the restless mind. Dr. Mark Epstein is a psychiatrist who combines elements of psychotherapy and Buddhist teaching in his private practice. And he's written a book explaining why. It's called Thoughts Without a Thinker. Epstein began studying meditation before entering medical school. At Harvard, he worked with Dr. Herbert Benson, who was a pioneer in studying stress reduction. Psychotherapy deals with neurosis. I asked Dr. Epstein if there's any equivalent concept in Buddhist thinking.
There is not an identical concept as neurosis in Buddhist thinking. Buddhist psychology has always been very phenomenological in its orientation. It was derived from people sitting for many years watching the quality of their own minds. And so what you find in Buddhist psychology is an identification of all the different mental states that can arise in a person's mind and how those mental states can be shaped by the practice of awareness. So there are concepts of greed or hatred or attachment, aversion, and ignorance in Buddhism, but not notions of neurosis per se.
Now, a lot of Freudian analysis traces problems back to feelings of sexual inadequacy or some kind of sexual-related
yes.
problem, or to problems relating to how your mother or your father treated you. This strikes me as a kind of un-Buddhist way of looking at life.
I'm not sure that it's particularly un-Buddhist. What Buddhism teaches is that all mental anguish is ultimately derived from some kind of craving. The word they use translates as either thirst or craving, some kind of desire or longing for things to be different. And much of sexuality, much remembered experience of one's childhood is colored by those feelings that Buddhism describes as central. So I think that Freud and all the psychoanalysts who followed him were attacking the same problem, almost as if from the outside, peeling away the skins of the onion. And what they saw first was sexuality, and Freud's great discovery, one of his great discoveries, was that children are sexual. Sexuality is everywhere. And when they peeled that away, then what they found was anger. The early primitive feelings of children with their mothers wanting more. And so there was a great interest in anger. And then they peeled anger away, and what they found was insecurity, fear and insecurity, that we're all driven by the sense that we're not good enough, and that's the psychology of narcissism. And as they peeled those layers away, they got closer and closer to what Buddhism has always been teaching.
You write in your new book that you've seen too many people go round and round in therapy, and occasionally they get insight, but the insight brings them no relief.
Yes.
And I think a lot of our listeners will know what you mean
yes.
when you say that. But so where does Buddhism come into play there?
Well, I also write, and I've also seen people who have gone round and round in meditation and have found no relief. So I want to make clear that I'm not setting one up as the cure for the other.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have found is that most people, at least in our culture, can make good use of both, and that each has something different to offer, so that what we find in Buddhism is an actual method, an actual technique of shaping the mind, of working directly in yourself on your own mind, and that can often make the difference for someone who has done good work in therapy, discovered where they're stuck, but still can't get past it. With the mental power that comes from working in meditation, it's possible really to go beyond where therapy leaves you off.
Can you think of an example of somebody you've worked with who has used meditation and psychotherapy in a complementary way and gone further than you think they would have with either one on its own?
Sure. I can give you certainly one example. A patient of mine who I have worked with for a long time had a disturbing habit of having a great deal of trouble letting go of interpersonal relationships, particularly sexual, eroticized relationships, that didn't work out. So he would go out with someone, fall in love with them, have a crush on them, however you want to phrase it. And when the relationship didn't last, he would become obsessed with that person and would feel an inner tension such that he had to pursue them, call them, write them, try to get them to explain what went wrong. And he was, you know, despite lots and lots of therapy, he was unable to stop himself. And what happened was that when I worked with him in therapy, not specifically with meditation, but in a therapy that was colored by my interest in meditation, I tried to get him to stop and feel the emotion or feeling that was happening just before he had to call. And he had a great deal of trouble doing that, but he finally got to a place where he was actually in touch with some kind of painful feeling that was happening mostly in his body that he could identify. He still didn't put this to use for a while, but several months later, he came back into my office and said to me, you know, I finally tried what you said, and instead of calling so-and-so's number when I was feeling this way, I just stopped, and it hurt so much, but I just kept repeating to myself, it hurts, and I didn't have to call. And that was the beginning for this man. That was the beginning of turning away from a terrible feeling of insufficiency and unworthiness that motivated this behavior that only alienated him further from other people. That was the beginning of him turning it around.
Memory is a very important part of analysis. I mean, part of what you're doing is trying to remember your past and make sense of it and understand how the past is shaping your present.
Yes.
What's the role of memory in meditation? And in the larger Buddhist way of thinking, and when I say Buddhist, I should say which school of Buddhism are we talking about that you have studied the most?
Well, there are three main schools of Buddhism, at least that are represented in this country. The first coming from Southeast Asia, from Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and some parts of India that teach a practice called Vipassana, which means insight meditation. Then there's Zen Buddhism, which comes primarily from Japan, China, Korea, and then Tibetan Buddhism. And I've had the most experience with the first, but some experience with the latter two. All of them are very similar in that the core meditation technique is a practice known as bare attention, B-A-R-E, like naked attention, simple, non-judgmental awareness of whatever is happening in the mind and body at any given moment. And the word, going to your second question about memory, the word in the Buddhist language for the kind of practice that is the core technique of all of Buddhism, the word translates as remembering. Because what you have to do is remember in every moment to bring your awareness back to whatever's happening right then. And that sounds simple, but turns out to be incredibly difficult. So in Buddhism, there's much more of a premium, much more importance is put on the here and now, that memories, as we think of them, memories of what went wrong in the past, when they come up, they're to be experienced as they're happening right now. Experienced, felt completely, attended to, and then let go of.
Well, now, what position does that put you in as the therapist? I mean, you're encouraging people, aren't you, to try to go deeper into their memories and understand more of the past. But the kind of meditation that you practice is about not dredging up memories, but just kind of letting them go by and remaining as much as you can in the present.
As a therapist, I'm encouraging people to be as much as possible in the present. And what happens is that they have a great deal of trouble doing that because of the intrusion of the past. And when the past intrudes upon the present in the therapy office, that's very interesting because that's the material that has brought someone into therapy and that's the material that we can work with. Usually what happens is that there are less specific memories of the past and more a feeling of absence where there should have been somebody or something present. That's usually the kind of memory that comes up these days. It's a memory of an attention that wasn't there. And when that comes up, that's the perfect thing to pay attention to, either in meditation or in therapy.
Tell me more about how you have combined meditation and psychotherapy, what you've learned from each in your own life.
In my own life, I think the way meditation has helped me the most, or the most often, is in working with my own difficult emotions. I recount in my book a couple of stories about myself, whereby even though I was having great good fortune in my own personal life, I had met the person who I subsequently married and had children with and was completely unambivalently in love with, that even then I was still plagued with a kind of childish anger and demandingness that was threatening to destroy the relationship. And it was really by using what I had learned from meditation to both permit those feelings but not be driven by them, in cooperation with a good therapist at that time, but it was really by putting into practice what I had learned in meditation that I was able to navigate that difficult emotional territory. And I think in terms of day-to-day life, that's probably the way it's helped me the most.
My guest is Mark Epstein. He's a psychiatrist who's also spent many years studying and practicing Buddhist meditation. He's written a new book called Thoughts Without a Thinker, Psychotherapy from a Buddhist Perspective. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. Back with psychiatrist Mark Epstein, author of Thoughts Without a Thinker, Psychotherapy from a Buddhist Perspective. In your practice, you're trying to combine certain insights you've gotten from studying Buddhism with the work that you do as a therapist. Now, we're in an era where a pharmacological approach seems to really be displacing the talk therapy model. It seems, you know, more and more that people are on antidepressants and other related drugs, and sometimes that's combined with talk therapy, sometimes it's not. And I wonder if you use a lot of antidepressants and other prescription drugs in your practice.
Well, people ask this question a lot. I think you're absolutely right. We are definitely in that era. I feel that one of the two or three things that that I learned in all of my medical school and psychiatric training had to do with the place of these drugs in people's mental suffering. There is definitely a place for them. I do use them when I feel that they're indicated. They are sometimes very helpful. They are by no means a panacea, but when they work, it feels like a godsend. So I do not keep people from using them out of some kind of Puritan or Buddhist ethic that they should be able to cure themselves with the power of their own minds. A lot of people in Buddhist circles or in Western circles of people who embrace spirituality do have a prejudice, which is a kind of backlash against the pharmacological approach. A lot of people do have a prejudice against using the medicine. And for those people, I often counsel, you know, where it's safe, which medicines work, and so on. But I do not think that the value of the medicines outweighs the value of a good talking therapy. And I think what we're actually seeing is a kind of backlash against the pharmacological takeover of psychotherapy, which is happening a lot in league with the managed care companies. And if it's not happening already, I think we'll see soon a resurgence of talk therapy, perhaps influenced by Buddhism.
How do you evaluate whether a person's mental suffering can be relieved by an antidepressant or whether more talk therapy and perhaps meditation is what's advised?
There are certain constellations of symptoms that are a tip-off as to whether a given medication will be of help. If there are a lot of symptoms in the body, difficulty sleeping, terrible anxiety, loss of appetite, difficulty concentrating, those kinds of symptoms will often alert me to the possibility that we're going to have to use medication here. And what I find is that if people are engaged in the therapy process, seem to be making good progress, but are not getting better, then I will start to ask the question to myself and then to them about introducing a pharmacological medication.
Now, you once went with other people from Harvard to study monks who were able to raise their body temperature.
Right.
Did they think that you were crazy coming there with all these fine tools of measurement?
Yeah, I think that they did, especially because one of the things that we had to do was to insert a rectal probe while they were meditating. And it was only because the Dalai Lama himself had asked these monks to please cooperate with us that that I think that they were able to. And they just looked at us with this kind of ironical, bemused look while we were fussing all around them. And they were very cooperative.
What did these monks do?
These monks were practicing an advanced form of Tibetan yoga called Tummo Yoga, which translates as heat yoga, in which they raise their inner temperatures so that, for instance, they can sit outside naked in freezing weather with wet sheets draped around their shoulders and dry them with their own body temperature. And these were practices that were documented almost 100 years ago by the French explorer Alexandra David Neal, who wrote a number of rather fantastic books about her journeys in Tibet. And we were unsure whether these practices actually existed or whether she had made them up when we first began the research. And we approached the Dalai Lama, asked him if, in fact, these practices were real, if they were still being done. He said, yes, they were. He could tell us some people who were doing them, and he thought it might be helpful for Western science to see the, you know, one example of what these practices could do and of what the mind was capable of.
The Dalai Lama wrote the introduction to your book, Thoughts Without a Thinker, and he writes, "The purpose of life is to be happy. As a Buddhist, I have found that one's own mental attitude is the most influential factor in working toward that goal." Do you agree with him when he says the purpose of life is to be happy?
That's actually a very radical statement and also a very Buddhist statement. And all of my Western background rebels against the simplicity of that statement.
Yes, and maybe your parents told you, as mine did, and probably everybody's did, that no one can be happy all the time. No one ever said you were put here to be happy.
That's the great thing about Buddhism. People always think that it's a pessimistic religion. Mm-hmm. You know, the first noble truth is that life is suffering. Buddhism has a very bad name for its pessimism, and yet it's relentlessly optimistic. You know, the purpose of life is to be happy. We all want happiness. We're all trying desperately through, usually in the wrong ways, to make ourselves happy by accumulating material things or by feeling that we have to pump up ourselves somehow. And I think the Dalai Lama, I have come to agree with him in spite of myself, is that if we can find the right path, that it's not only is it the purpose of life, but it's also a possibility.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Dr. Mark Epstein is the author of Thoughts Without a Thinker, which has just been published in paperback. This is Fresh Air.